Good afternoon, and welcome to Reminiscing, a program of nostalgia and recollections of the good old days, times that we remember as happy and maybe a little simpler. We know we can't go back, but we certainly can reminisce. This is your volunteer reader, Mary Ellen Stepanek, and you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, your 24-hour reading station. Hello again. Well, as April winds down, we're left with just a potpourri of articles in the Good Old Days magazine for April. Here's one entitled, Memories from a Cardboard Box. How could they know that the tricks they tried as children would be part of their lives as adults? Now, this was written and sent in by Carol Ann Lake. In the early 1950s, I was a toddler of about 2.5 years of age. My brother was 8 years older, and my sister 4 years older than me. Most of the time, I was an observer of their very busy lives, or a pest getting in their way. On one particular afternoon, we were gathered in the kitchen while our mother worked between the kitchen sink and the stove. My brother had acquired 2 large cardboard boxes and was attempting to construct a magic trick. He was reconstructing the illusion of the sword through the box, which was originally designed and constructed by a magician in 1924. We had magic shows, cowboys, and Saturday matinees for entertainment in our area. Those performers were our heroes and mentors. At about that time, our mother discovered that she was missing something she needed for that night's dinner. She told us she was just going to run out for a few minutes to our aunt's small grocery store, which was adjacent to our home. It was only going to be a few minutes. My brother was nearly 11, and all was well, for the moment. During those few minutes, my sister, as the lovely lady assistant, was to enter box number 2, and without being seen, sneak over to box number 1. Box number 2 would remain empty and would be pierced with a sword made of forged steel with a blade sharp enough to cut a hair in half, or with a pocket knife with a blade about 2 inches long and as dull as butter knife, whichever was more readily available. Details on how all of this was going to work were sketchy then and are even sketchier today. Unbeknownst to my brother, I had actually joined my sister in box number 2, but I never left. I remained there, sitting quietly, waiting to see whatever was about to amaze us. My head was just under the top of the box when my brother suddenly pierced box number 2 with the pocket knife and put a nick in my scalp. Not expecting this ill treatment, I started howling, and my sister started screaming. Being the assistant, she grabbed a half bottle of mercurochrome from the medicine cabinet and poured it on the top of my head so that it dripped down my face and back. She then ran out the door and met my mother halfway as she was coming back home from the store. "Mom, Dennis stabbed Carol in the head," she screamed. The real victim was most likely our mother, who could barely keep her leg supporting her to make it to the door. There I sat in a pool of fluorescent pink, my white blonde wisps of hair smelling medicinal and looking like an exotic bird. Mom had no idea what was blood and what was mercurochrome. Searching through my scalp, she could find no wound, but possibly identified a small scratch. By then I was only crying because I knew something terrible had happened, and it was most likely the end of me. In the pandemonium that followed, I think the familiar words, "Wait until your father gets home," were spoken when our mom could speak again. That night, the boxes were burned to a soft pile of ash, carried off on the breeze. The knife was confiscated. My sister was waiting for her hero's recognition, and my hair was scrubbed several times until it was a softer shade of pink. After our bedtime, which I think came extra early that night, our mom probably hit the cooking sherry, but we have no actual proof of that. 21 years later, I married a magician. And yes, we have done the sword through the box illusion many times. As of yet, we have not needed any mercurochrome or bandages. My brother also became a magician, entertaining young children for many years. Apparently, there was magic dust in our blood all along. And this was Memories from a Cardboard Box by Carol Ann Lake. This next story is entitled Birthday Surprises. As the boys were catching up to the girls, she was reminded what day it was, times two. This was sent in by Carla Cooper. I wasn't sure if it was because of something wonderful or a crisis, but I gradually came to realize that Dad was shaking me awake. "It's very early. Get up quietly and come downstairs," he whispered. "You're not going to school today." Then, wide-eyed and completely awake, I heard the rest of his words. "Mom and I are going to the hospital as soon as you're dressed. She's having the baby today. And happy birthday." My 11th birthday, September 25th, 1953, began like no other. Tiptoeing downstairs, I found Mom seated at the dining room table while Dad carried a small suitcase out to the car. The rising sun on that cool Des Plaines, Illinois morning promised warmth later on, but I barely noticed the weather because of all my questions. Carefully, Mom and Dad explained that I was to stay home with my youngest brother and sister. The other three children would go to school as usual, and our family friend, Mrs. Fisher, would stop in to help if needed. This new baby would be our seventh sibling. So my birthday already held a mixture of surprise and possible challenges. As the oldest child, I had helped care for the others before. But now I would babysit all day, not just for a short time. After a breakfast of cornflakes with sliced bananas, buttered toast, and juice, Vic, age 9, Barbie, age 7, and Marie, age 6, were off to school several blocks away, carrying the lunches that Mom had already prepared. Peter, 4 years old, and Jenny, just 3, played for a while as I cleaned up breakfast things. There was no fussing or fighting. Our day was going well so far. I got them dressed and then straightened up our bedrooms. Finding an overflowing clothes hamper, I carried it down to the basement washer. Sorting and starting a load went well, as I had accomplished that several times before. While I was in the basement, I heard the doorbell ring. Once I was upstairs, I could see our neighbor at the screen door. Could it be close to noon already? My morning seemed to have flown by. Mrs. Fisher brought us a small plate of oatmeal cookies. Accepting a cup of coffee, she sat across from me at the dining room table and asked how things were going. Assured from my accounts that we were all okay, she announced the news. "Your dad called me just a little while ago to say the baby is a boy. Your mom and the new baby are just fine. Your dad's going to check in to his workplace for the remainder of the day, and he'll see you this afternoon. A boy? I felt intrigued. Keeping score, I noted that the boys were starting to catch up, 3 boys to 4 girls. After Mrs. Fisher left to prepare lunch for her own younger children, I fixed Campbell's soup and peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for our lunch. We enjoyed Mrs. Fisher's cookies, too. Nap time for Pete and Jenny followed lunch. It was time to start another load of laundry and put the first one in the dryer. Our washer at that time was a heavy wringer washer that we attached to 2 stationary tubs to make use of a soap saver feature. The machine sometimes did a funny little dance, inching across the slanted basement floor as it worked on heavy loads. We used an old broom handle to bring up the rinsed clothes to the wringer. But because of our growing family and earlier experiences with frozen diapers retrieved from the outdoor clothesline, my parents had acquired a Bendix clothes dryer at some point. After that job was taken care of, I did sit down for a while. The house seemed very empty and very quiet. Coming down the stairs from checking on my napping siblings, I imagined for a minute that this might be the time of day that Mom used for herself, possibly taking a nap herself. The house was so still. Dad called just about then, asking how we were doing. I stood on the bottom step of the phone shelf and listened as he, sounding excited, told me about the night, just as if I were another adult. Though I'm sure he'd been telling those details to everyone he met that day. In mid-afternoon, Dad took an earlier commuter train to his car and returned home before his usual time, just about the same moment the school kids bounced into the house. Sometime in that happy confusion, another thought dawned on me. I was still the birthday girl. Now this new baby and I would always share a birthday, exactly 11 years apart. I wondered then, Dad didn't say, what our parents would decide to call the marvel of my new baby brother. I felt especially grown up because he shared all the details with me, size and everything about the new birthday boy. Like viewing a stored away movie reel, I will always be able to visualize that day. Happy birthday, Johnny. Happy birthday to both of us. And this was Birthday Surprises by Carla Cooper. Now here's a story that we didn't have time to read on Easter. It's entitled Easter for a Large Family. It was a wonderful celebration that even a couple of greedy squirrels could not spoil. This was written and sent in by Barbara Young. Our family was fairly large, with Mom and Dad, 4 boys and 3 girls. Aunts, uncles, and cousins on both sides of the family lived nearby in the area around Springfield, Illinois. We always got together on Easter Sunday. All of us, nieces and nephews and cousins, along with the new babies in our family, wore our Easter finery, dresses for the girls, and new suits for the boys. Some of their suits came with vests and shiny new shoes. The older girls always wore white gloves and Easter bonnets with plenty of flowers. On those bright, sunny Easter Sundays, we were invited to Grandma's for a delicious home-cooked meal. Grandma was famous for those. And on this particular Easter in 1969, after we all ate, we were told there was going to be a surprise event for us kids out in her backyard. But before all that could happen, we went to church and enjoyed the Easter Sunday service. It included baptisms of some boys and girls. The baptism consisted of being dunked in water. The clergyman tipped you backward while you pinched your nose shut. Each person was given a gown to wear for the baptism, and then they changed back into their Easter finery afterward. After church was over, people chatted with the minister, shaking his hand and saying they had enjoyed the sermon. He was also invited to Grandma's for dinner. She lived just down the road in a big house on the farm where they'd been raising corn for 20 years. The night before Easter, the adults had placed plastic Easter eggs full of candy in Grandma's grassy backyard. How pretty they looked, blue, yellow, orange, red, purple, and green. They were so excited to see how the kids would like this surprise after Easter dinner. Everyone imagined the kids running everywhere looking for those eggs. The next day, after church, everyone came to Grandma's front door. The table was all set. There was a warm aroma of sliced ham with all the trimmings. In the corner was a table with apple pie, chocolate brownies, and sugar cookies. Everyone found a seat around the table. The smaller kids had a table of their own in the kitchen. The minister blessed the food with prayer. Everyone said the food was delicious and complimented Grandma. After coffee and dessert, the minister asked everyone to go outside and enjoy the beautiful spring day. The adults drifted outside, followed by the kids, who were excited for the promised Easter surprise. But then it seemed like everyone shouted at the same time. What happened? All of the colorful eggs were open and the candy was gone. Everyone was baffled. Right at that moment, two squirrels popped onto the top of the fence. That was it. Squirrels. But now, what to do for the kids? Grandma had the answer. She had the adults gather the eggs the squirrels had left. She had spoons and tiny donuts to put in each plastic egg, and she lined them up in two rows, 10 feet apart. We were going to have an Easter egg roll. The first one to get to the finish line would get a plush rabbit, not a squirrel. One of the boys won the rabbit, and the others enjoyed their donuts. Easter was different that year, but it was still fun. And this was Easter for a Large Family by Barbara Young. And here's another little leftover Easter story. It's entitled Our Easter Gift. This was sent in by Eileen Hamden. Spring has always been my favorite time of year. The sun starts to reappear to usher in the singing birds, the little bunnies, and the mischievous squirrels. Easter Sunday held much anticipation. In April 1960, we were all celebrating the arrival of my new baby brother, Sean. 2 weeks earlier, my parents had awakened me in the middle of the night after Mom went into labor. We piled into the old Oldsmobile and raced off to Renton Hospital. A few days later, Sean was brought home. I was only 7 and a half, but quickly I became the official older sister, helping to take care of him. My favorite part was feeding him his bottle. That Easter, Uncle Ronnie and Aunt Julie arrived to greet the new baby and go to church with us. We all dressed up as blessings of joy filled the house. Mother was always thoughtful of me, as she was afraid my baby brother would get too much attention. so she scheduled fun things for me to do. The Saturday before that Easter Sunday, I got to go with the neighbors to Kent, Washington, for a large Easter egg hunt in the community park. The place was crawling with children. We collected a lot of candy that day. By the age of 7, I had collected my share of large Easter baskets, but I always looked forward to my mom's special treat for me. Hidden in the refrigerator, there was always a special little box holding a large chocolate egg. And Mom had the bakery pipe my name, Eileen, on top with icing. It was so pretty and so full of love. My mom always tried to surprise me, but it never took long for me to catch on. And this was Our Easter Gift by Eileen Harnden. For those of you listeners who grew up during World War II, as I did, this article is very interesting. It's entitled Children and the War Effort. He grew up waiting for life to get back to normal. This was sent in by Ken Newser. The so-called Silent Generation, 1928 to 1945, are currently in their 80s to mid-90s. The oldest silents grew up with both the extreme economic deprivation of the Great Depression and the terrifying upheaval of World War II. Some say memory is sugar-coated. Not so for the silent generation. The hovering dark cloud of World War II dictated many aspects of our lives. The two-front war created a cosmic darkness. Living in the shipbuilding center of Manitowoc, Miss, Wisconsin, made us a likely target, though no attack ever occurred. My dad served as an air raid warden, checking his assigned area of the neighborhood to make certain blackout shades were pulled. As a passionate part of America's home front, we children feared that Hitler would, of course, make us his first target. We huddled together in darkness, as sirens wailed, waiting for Dad to return. He always did. More good news. The war brought Manitowoc out of the Depression. 28 submarines were built there. Spectacular launchings for the war effort. As children, we learned to wait. We waited at home as our mothers counted tiny ration stamps to buy food and other commodities. We waited and watched Mother search for wartime cookbooks to find substitutes because of food shortages. We waited in lines at school to buy war stamps, clutching shiny dimes, hoping to fill a war bond booklet to help soldiers and the home front fight the war. That $18.75 would be worth $25 in 10 years. We waited and we did without. Everything seemed to be rationed. Each member of the family had his or her own ration book that held tiny stamps which were torn out by the grocer when a purchase was made. This system operated under the Office of Price Administration, or the OPA, ensured that each family received their fair share of rationed food, and that there would be some left for those who had not yet shopped. There were 48 blue points for canned goods and 64 red points for perishables. The ration coupon price of any given item regularly fluctuated along with the cash price. The first food to be rationed was sugar, allotting 1 pound per week per person. Hoarding was out. People took care of each other and tried in various ways to help in the war effort. War cakes were made with bacon grease instead of shortening, with spices added to cover the flavor. The long list of rationed items included gasoline, chewing gum, butter, and meat. Some items could not be purchased at all, like radios, washing machines, electric irons, and toasters. If your refrigerator didn't work, you were fortunate to find an old icebox. During the war years, there were shortages of just about everything. Gasoline was strictly limited, and those who had automobiles were forced to leave them parked for all but essential travel. As young patriots on the home front, we helped collect rubber, scrap metal, tinfoil from packs of cigarettes and chewing gum, and even cans of fat for the war effort. Mothers saved snippets of soap and the grease from cooking. Teachers organized newspaper and scrap drives to salvage commodities for the war effort. Get in the scrap was a way of family life. Mills could recycle waste paper quickly, and at 50% of the cost of newly made paper. Industry needed razor blades, aluminum, toothpaste tubes, bottle caps, old pans, golf clubs, and car fenders to turn into planes, tanks, ships, and ammunition. Save, serve, conserve became a popular slogan. Used flashlight batteries provided zinc, brass, and copper. War factories transformed millions of old tires, rubber boots, and hot water bottles into tank treads and new tires for military vehicles. Win with tin was another popular war cry. Even animal bones were useful. Salvaged bones could supply tons of material to make glue. Manual labor was a must even for the young. Whole families worked in their victory gardens. Small vegetable plots popped up everywhere, from backyards to parks to city rooftops. By 1943, 20 million victory gardens on a total of 4 million acres supplied a third of the nation's vegetables, answering the call to grow your own, can your own. Americans were encouraged to return to the soil and grow what food they could to supplement the meager rations we were permitted to buy. Many people went deer and squirrel hunting to put food on the table. And that is the way I remember World War II. You've been listening to Reminiscing on Sun Sounds of Arizona, Arizona's 24-hour reading station. This is your volunteer reader, Dr. Mary Ellen Stepanek, wishing you good afternoon and good memories.